said Moody, thinking this a rather alarming prospect.
"Everyone's from somewhere else," Balfour went on. "Yes, that's the very heart of it. We're all from somewhere else. And as for family, you'll find brothers and fathers enough in the gorge."
"You are kind to offer comfort." Balfour was grinning broadly now.
"There's a phrase," he said,
waving his cigar with such emphasis that he scattered feathers of ash all over his vest.
"Comfort! If this counts as comfort, then you're a very Puritan, my boy."
Moody could not produce an appropriate response to this remark, so he bowed again, and then, as if to repudiate all puritanical implication, he drank deeply from his glass. Outside, a gust of wind interrupted the steady lash of the rain, throwing a sheet of water against the western windows. Balfour examined the end of his cigar, still chuckling. Moody placed his own between his lips, turned his face away, and drew lightly upon it. Just then, one of the 11 silent men got to his feet, folding his newspaper into quarters as he did so, and crossed to the secretary in order to exchange the paper for another. He was wearing a collarless black coat and a white necktie. A clergyman's dress, Moody realized with some surprise. That was strange. Why should a cleric elect to get his news in the smoking room of a common hotel late on a Saturday night? And why should he keep such silent company in doing so? Moody watched as the reverend man shuffled through the pile of broadsheets, rejecting several editions of The Colonist in favour of a Grey River Argus, which he plucked out with a murmur of pleasure, holding it away from his body and tilting it with appreciation towards the light. Then again, Moody thought, reasoning with himself, perhaps it was not so strange. The night was very wet, and the halls and taverns of the town were likely very crowded. Perhaps the chaplain had been obliged for some reason to seek temporary refuge from the rain.
"So, you had a quarrel," Balfour said presently, as if Moody had promised him a rousing tale and had then forgotten to begin it.
"I was party to a quarrel," Moody corrected him. "That is, the dispute was not of my own making."
"With your father, I suppose?"
"It is painful to relate, sir." Moody glanced at the other man, meaning to silence him with a stern look. But Balfour responded by leaning further forward, encouraged by the gravity of Moody's expression, to believe the story all the more worth his hearing.
"Oh, come," he said. "Ease your burden."
"It is not a burden to be eased, Mr. Balfour."
"My friend, I've never heard of such a thing."
"Pardon me to change the subject."
"But you have roused me. You have roused my attention."
Balfour was grinning at him.
"I beg to refuse you," Moody said. He was trying to speak quietly, to protect their conversation from the rest of the room. "I beg to reserve my privacy. My motive is purely that I do not wish to make a poor impression upon you."
"But you're the wronged man," you said. "The dispute, not of your making."
"That is correct."
"Well now, one needn't be private about that," Balfour cried. "Do I not speak truly? One needn't be private about another fellow's wrong. One needn't feel ashamed of another fellow's deeds, you know."
He was being very loud.
"You describe personal shame," Moody said in a low voice. "I refer to the shame that is brought upon a family. I do not wish to sully my father's name. It is my name also."
"Your father? What have I told you already? You'll find fathers enough," I said, "down in the gorge. That's no turn of phrase. It's custom and necessity. It's the way that things are done. Let me tell you what counts for shame on the diggings. Cry a false field, that's worthy. Dispute the pegging on a claim, that's worthy. Rob a man, cheat a man, kill a man, that's worthy. But family shame? Tell that to the bellman to cry up and down the Hokitika Road. They'll think it news. What's family shame without a family?"
Balfour concluded this exhortation with a smart rap of his empty glass upon the arm of his chair. He beamed at Moody and lifted his open palm, as if to say that his point had been so persuasively phrased as to need no further amendment, but he would like some kind of approbation all the same.
Moody gave another automatic jerk of his head and replied in a tone that betrayed the exhaustion of his nerves for the first time,
"You speak persuasively, sir."
Balfour, still beaming, waved the compliment aside.
"Persuasions, tricks and cleverness. I'm speaking plain."
"I thank you for it."
"Yes, yes,"
Balfour said agreeably. He seemed to be enjoying himself very much.
"But now you must tell me about your family quarrel, Mr. Moody, so that I may judge if your name is sullied in the end."
"Forgive me,"
Moody murmured. He glanced about, perceiving that the clergyman had returned to his seat and was now absorbed in his paper. The man next to him, a florid type with an imperial moustache and gingery hair, appeared to have fallen asleep. Thomas Balfour was not to be deterred.
"Liberty and security," he cried, waving his arm again. "Is that not what it comes down to? You see, I know the argument already. I know the form of it. Liberty over security, security over liberty. Provision from the father, freedom for the son. Of course, the father might be too controlling, that can happen, and the son might be wasteful, prodigal. But it's the same quarrel every time."
"Lovers, too," he added, when Moody did not interject.
"It's the same for lovers, too. At bottom, always the same dispute."
But Moody was not listening. He had forgotten for a moment the creeping ash of his cigar and the warm brandy pooling in the bottom of his glass. He had forgotten that he was here, in a hotel smoking room, in a town not 5 years built, at the end of the world. His mind had slipped and returned to it. The bloody cravat, the clutching silver hand, the name gasped out of the darkness again and again.
"Magdalena, Magdalena, Magdalena."
The scene came back to him all in a snatch, unbidden, like a shadow passing coldly over the face of the sun. Moody had sailed from Port Chalmers aboard the bark Godspeed, a stout little craft with a smartly raked bow and a figurehead of painted oak, an eagle, after St. John. On a map, the journey took the shape of a hairpin. The bark set off northward, traversed the narrow strait between two seas, and then turned south again to the diggings. Moody's ticket afforded him a narrow space below decks, but the hold was so foul-smelling and close that he was compelled to spend most of the voyage topside, hunched below the gunwales with his leather case clasped wetly to his chest and his collar turned up against the spray.